Welcome to SILRAP Podcasts. You are about to listen to a service of the Center for International Law Research and Policy.
My co-author Alex is also here. Thank you all. Thank you to the organizers of the conference and to all of you who have stayed for the last presentations of the day, and no less from a philosopher, so hopefully it won't be too boring. All right, so the increased power and independence of the Office of the Prosecutor, especially in the preliminary examinations phase, has brought more attention to the ways in which prosecutors can exercise discretion in choosing which situations warrant investigation by the ICC. Under Article 15 of the Rome Statute, the prosecutor has the authority to initiate investigations proprio motu on the basis of information on crimes within the jurisdiction of the court. There are no specific requirements as to where the prosecutor is to get this information or how she is to analyze the seriousness of the information received. Similar concerns are raised with regard to other trigger mechanisms. Although the requirement that the pretrial chamber must grant an authorization for a proprio motu investigation constrains the discretion of the prosecutor, there are generally no checks on her determination that there is or is not a reasonable basis to proceed with an investigation. The influence of political considerations is apparent in the prosecutorial discretion exercised during this preliminary examinations phase, and the permissible invocation of these political considerations generates significant concerns about fairness. Evaluations of selection decisions are much more important for the ICC's legitimacy than for that of most national criminal law systems, where prosecutors' discretionary decisions not to prosecute very rarely spark a challenge to the legitimacy of the entire criminal justice system. In contrast, since the ICC can only prosecute a handful of cases out of thousands of potential cases, each decision can be seen as a statement about how the court views its role in the world. This role is fairly new, and the court must still worry about how it is perceived in different communities. In our paper, we argue that common sense morality is not a sufficient check on the prosecutorial discretion of the OTP during the preliminary examinations phase. Rather, we argue that the prosecutor's discretion to invoke political considerations when analyzing whether proceeding with an investigation is in the interests of justice should be limited by both deontological and consequentialist constraints, and that consequentialist political considerations should sometimes be prioritized to ensure the functioning of the ICC. I will now briefly walk through the various parts of this argument. We begin by arguing that the obligations associated with prosecutorial ethics are both deontological and consequentialist. We argue that in the pretrial phase, consequentialist considerations should play a significant role. So we can first distinguish between legal and moral obligations, and perhaps the easiest way to think about the difference between them is in terms of how they are enforced and what sanctions are imposed for failures. So if you look on your handout, I use the word, or the Greek symbol phi, to refer to a generic act. So that's what that is. So a legal obligation is one is legally obligated to phi in that one might be subject to legal sanctions if one fails to phi. Whereas a moral obligation, the sanctions that you might face would be social sanctions, social blame, or maybe even self-blame if you fail to phi. So systems of prosecutorial ethics consist of moral obligations that are also legal obligations, which make the obligations legally enforceable. So one might be subject to both moral blame and legal sanctions for failures to meet ethical obligations under a system of prosecutorial ethics. We can also think of obligations or actions in terms of how they are required or permitted by normative moral theories. The two moral theories we consider are deontological and consequentialist theories. Deontological theories are duty-based. These kinds of constraints make an action obligatory, prohibited, or permissible based on the intrinsic nature of the act. So that act, no matter what else is happening, is always going to have that value status. And so it will be independent of the value the action produces or is anticipated might produce. We could also think of these kinds of considerations as Kantian, as he believed that all rational beings are of unconditional value and dignity, and thus everyone must be treated as ends in themselves. Note that these constraints are usually formulated in the negative. Deontological constraints identify that a particular action is impermissible, such as you may not kill, but they don't necessarily require a particular action, such as you may cross the river however you like, as long as you don't kill anyone. That would be an example of a deontological constraint. On the other hand, we have consequentialist considerations, and these are based on either actual or anticipated consequences. For our purposes, we'll say anticipated consequences. And one of these considerations is going to make an action obligatory based on the outcomes that the action is anticipated it will produce. So one type of consequentialism, which we refer to as flat-footed consequentialism, measures the consequences of every individual action and demands that the action that will produce the best consequences is the one that is required. We'll return in a little bit to an alternative way of looking at consequentialism, which involves looking at institutions rather than individual actions. So a consequentialist who cares about maintaining institutions, because they believe these institutions will generate the most good in the long run, will be happy to follow rules that make up parts of these institutions. It is likely clear how deontological constraints are relevant for prosecutors at every stage of a trial, but that at least flat-footed consequentialist considerations could lead to procedural unfairness. But in terms of making choices about how a prosecutor's office spends resources, consequentialism has an important role to play. Turning to international criminal law, we've identified two foundational issues that have to be addressed in trying to justify the moral foundations of international criminal law: jus puniendi and universal jurisdiction. So international criminal law recognizes human dignity as a source of fundamental human rights. Here we can see the deontological basis for human rights, reflecting a belief that all humans are equal and worthy of respect. The OTP should not balance the rights of one individual over any other and should seek to punish any people who deny the human dignity of others. The international community then gains a jus puniendi from the obligation to enforce fundamental human rights. Once this has been established for the international community, the principle of universal jurisdiction then allows for a global prosecution of extraterritorial crimes. This principle is premised on the idea that the whole of civilization or humanity is harmed by certain crimes. In light of the existence of these crimes, the purpose of the ICC then is to ensure that international justice is respected and enforced. And here we can see where consequentialist considerations come into play. If we think that all of humanity is harmed by certain crimes, in order to respect the human dignity of these victims, we might find ourselves in situations where we think the moral obligation of the OTP is to favor the interests of all of humanity over the interests of a few individuals. At some point, the cost of absolute deontology will be too high, or it will be practically impossible for an ICC with limited resources. So in our third section, we identify what the system of prosecutorial ethics currently looks like for the OTP. It consists of ethical rules and then corresponding accountability mechanisms. We focus on the former since those are the direct obligations. So the main sources of ethical rules for the OTP are the Rome Statute and the Rules of Procedure and Evidence, the regulations of the OTP and the OTP Code of Conduct, and strategy and policy papers. On the system of prosecutorial ethics, we'll just note that most of the ethical obligations rely on a vague conception of common sense morality. We find this insufficient for adequately directing the OTP as to what considerations should play into their discretionary decisions. For instance, Article 42.3 of the Rome Statute notes that the prosecutor and deputy prosecutors shall be persons of high moral character. The OTP Code of Conduct is slightly more specific and notes that the prosecutor and deputy prosecutors should be faithful, conscientious, impartial, and independent. This sounds like Aristotle's virtue ethics, a normative ethical theory that says one should act virtuously or act like the virtuous man would. This theory doesn't give much concrete direction about how you should act in a particular situation. Similarly, neither the Code of Conduct nor the Rome Statute give concrete standards for the OTP to use when balancing competing ethical obligations and trying to decide whether or not to continue with a particular investigation. So moving to preliminary examinations, we identify Article 53(1)(c) of the Rome Statute as the main site of OTP discretion during this preliminary examination phase. We argue that the OTP must balance the interests of both global and local justice when determining whether or not to proceed with an investigation. We've already discussed the idea of all of humanity as the wronged entity in a crime of mass atrocity. This corresponds to the idea of global justice, where we hold individuals accountable based on crimes of mass atrocity as crimes against all people throughout the world. If we think about justice as global, then everyone counts as a victim, at least to some extent, in a justice assessment. This is supported by the idea of fundamental human rights, and it is also supported by the idea that the ICC serves an expressive purpose of showing that crimes against humanity will not be met with impunity. But fundamental human rights also suggests that we might be required to care more about the direct victims of crime than the abstract victims of mass atrocity. This lends itself to thinking about local justice, holding individuals accountable for crimes of mass atrocity, where the crime is a crime against the individual direct victims and perhaps their immediate community. The specific interests of direct victims may be quite different from those of the international community of abstract victims. It might sometimes look like the tension between justice and peace, but it could also involve all sorts of other factors. We could imagine, for instance, a scenario in which local victims want an investigation to go forward, but that investigation might cause several regional powers to question the legitimacy of the court and pull out of the Rome Statute. In this situation, the OTP should be required to use consequentialist considerations when making discretionary decisions about investigations, within the bounds of deontological constraints as well, and taking into account the continued existence of the institution of the ICC. And this is where the priority of global justice comes into play. This doesn't mean that countries should be permitted to hold the court hostage through blackmail or threats of noncompliance or non-participation. But these sorts of threats would ultimately threaten the institution itself. So these sorts of flat-footed consequentialist arguments would not be supported. Ultimately, the interests of justice might look very different depending on who counts as a victim under the analysis. And sometimes it will be impossible to promote a deontological view of the equality of individuals at the same time that we are seeking legal and moral accountability for crimes of mass atrocity. So the main upshot of this paper, then, is about the ethical obligations that are owed to the victims of mass atrocities. These are broader than those owed specifically by the OTP, but the assessment of the interests of justice is within the OTP's purview during the preliminary examination stage. Political considerations will play a role at this point, and we argue that they should be permitted and perhaps even required to do so, as constrained by deontological concerns about respecting the dignity of every individual. Direct victims cannot be ignored, but the maintenance and effectiveness of the ICC as a new institution should influence the choices the OTP makes in this stage, and thus the OTP needs to prioritize all of humanity as the relevant set of victims or potential victims. Our final contribution is a set of very general suggestions about how to ensure that the OTP has more direction in how to balance and prioritize the relevant ethical considerations in assessing whether or not an investigation is in the interests of justice. We have already argued that a reliance on common sense morality is insufficient, so we suggest revisions in the form of clarifications and concretizations to the ethical rules governing the OTP that reflect the following concerns. So global justice and concerns about punishing individuals for the global harm they inflict rather than just the local harm they're inflicting. Retribution and deterrence are not sufficient or practical bases for generating these sorts of selection criteria. A prosecutorial strategy must always be measured in light of maintaining the actual and perceived legitimacy and effectiveness of the ICC. The effectiveness of an institution, in turn, depends on the execution of its mandate, and this mandate is going to be first and foremost consequentialist. The consequentialist dimension of prosecutorial discretion is restricted by an international harm principle. So we have a moral argument for thinking that group-based harm is going to matter more than these individualized harms. So in closing, we argue that the foundations of prosecutorial discretion, particularly during the preliminary examination stage, must be more than mere platitudes about doing your job with honor and avoiding serious misconduct in carrying out your duty.
Thank you for listening. For more open access audio recordings, films, and publications, go to SILRAP.org.